And I don't know, how's the temperature? Is it okay or all right? So when I ask the question, what is the most important quality to bring to meditation, I mean that in a very broad way, not just in this formal sitting practice, but really what's the most important quality to bring into our day-to-day living. And this talk and the question was inspired by a talk by Ajahn Tanisaro, who is one of the major translators of the Pali text. He is a monk out in California now, but he's practiced a lot in Asia. And I heard his talk after I've been practicing for over 10 years. And I thought, wow, there's a framework. Now, I'm kind of a delusional type, so maybe that's why I didn't catch it. I don't know. But I really, my experience was that I'd come here, I'd practiced at Insight Meditation Society, and I actually had some reasonable realizations, and yet I really didn't understand the framework of this practice and how useful the framework can be. So Ajahn Tanisaro started off his talk by asking people what they thought the most important quality to bring to meditation was, so I thought I'd try the same thing. Anybody have any idea?
Presence.
Openness.
Earnestness.
That's what my teacher used to always tell me, and actually what she meant is I was kind of delusional, but I was trying hard. But earnestness is a good quality if it's real earnestness. Anybody else? Okay. Well, you might be interested in what the Buddha had to say about it. He said appropriate attention. Or sometimes just translated as wise attention. And so attention is our ability is to focus on something in particular, right? And so then what's appropriate? Appropriate attention is to practice within this framework of these Four Noble Truths. That they actually have a structure to them, and it's appropriate to bring in particular aspects of them depending on what happens to be going on at any particular moment. So I want to minimize my use of Pali tonight because my friend of mine says, you shouldn't do that. But I'm going to use a few Pali words, which is the textual language that the Buddha's teaching was written down in. And the problem is that a lot of the translations are different, and the Pali texts just don't translate very well. So it's I want to be a little bit precise about some things. I think it's valuable. So the first noble truth, or ennobling truth, is there is dukkha. And we're supposed to see that and understand it. And dukkha is usually translated as suffering or stress. Well, actually, it's usually translated as suffering. And Ajahn Tanisaro said, it's kind of like Rachmaninoff, you know, it's kind of dramatic, all my suffering. And so he may call it stress or dissatisfaction. And often we don't know we're having dukkha. There was someone who is actually a very serious practitioner who was here very early years of the center, and she had been separating from someone in another tradition and having a very difficult time with it. And Larry Rosenberg, who founded the center, said, well, I'm sorry you're suffering so much. And she said, suffering? I'm not suffering. I just hate her. So actually, hatred is probably a form of dukkha. And I think one of the interesting things is that the Buddha really never defined dukkha. He wants you to figure it out yourself. And what he does is to give examples. So I thought I'd read the first ennobling truth. He said, now this is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Associated with the unbeloved is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. In short, now this is interesting. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. The five clinging aggregates. So what are the five clinging aggregates? Okay. I'm going to get to that in a bit. So I was kind of curious, and I was on accesstoinsight.org, which is a nice little website for this tradition. And I found a modern definition of dukkha. So in case you haven't found something in what I've read so far that you experience as dukkha. So here it is. Disturbance, irritation, dejection, worry, despair, fear, dread, anguish, anxiety, vulnerability, injury, inability, inferiority, sickness, aging, decay of the body and faculties, senility, pain / pleasure, excitement / boredom, deprivation / excess, desire / frustration, hope / hopelessness, effort, activity, striving, repression, loss, want, insufficiency, satiety, love, lovelessness, friendlessness, dislike, aversion, attraction, parenthood, childlessness, submission, rebellion, decision, indecisiveness, facilitation, and uncertainty. Essentially, you know, what the Buddha is saying is don't cling to words. Don't cling to concepts. To see for yourself what's going on. If there's some form of stress or dissatisfaction, or really there's no language for it, that can be released. And what the Buddha really meant by the end of dukkha is something so subtle that we wouldn't think of it as suffering or stress. And essentially, it's the sense of someone outside the experience. It's someone that it's all happening to. This is a fabrication of the mind. It's a concept. And it's an interpretation of the nervous system, actually. It's a wrong interpretation, and it causes lots of problems. So I want to then talk about the five clinging aggregates. What are they? Because it's not the totality of suffering, but this is really something to focus on, an aspect of suffering that one can look at and see the cause. An interesting thing about dukkha is it has a cause. It originates, and therefore it can come to an end, which is the third ennobling truth. There is cessation. It's really quite an uplifting message that all this stuff can be brought to an end. I mean, that's quite a list, right? How can that happen? So the five clinging aggregates are form, which is just the material world as we perceive it, as this mind-body complex perceives it, which includes what's external and internal. An aspect of that is what we call body, but if actually body is a concept. If you start looking at what the body is, there's a visual image of a body, there's the sensation of pressure, and there's a movement of air, there's heat. It's not something solid. And actually, one of the things he wants us to see is that it's not solid. It's constantly changing. So feeling and perception, feeling is really just things are either pleasant, neutral, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's it. And it could be physical sensations or it could be emotions. And then perception is the way we separate things out and interpret things. So, you know, people who are born blind and get their sight back cannot separate out objects. That's a learned experience. And so our perceptions are learned not only in that way, but also we're totally conditioned by our society, all kinds of perceptions, the appropriate way to dress, the appropriate way to act. Okay, so these are things that we cling to. We want pleasant feelings, don't want unpleasant ones. We have views about how people should dress. I used to walk through the airport and see how people looked, and I just see, oh, there's this perception, there's that perception. All this conditioning is there. So form, feelings, perception, mental fabrication, and consciousness. So mental fabrication are thoughts and emotions, essentially. And a lot of them are the stories we tell. And in one level, the Buddha's asking, he's really offering something incredibly profound. He's saying what we are the coming together of these aggregates. Like a car is the coming together of the wheel and the motor and the windshield, all organized in a particular way. What we perceive as ourselves is the same thing. And that if we can see through this, that what we are, what we perceive ourselves to be or believe ourselves to be, are these, just these, and it's just the model. It's a particular model. But he was incredible. He had all these different ways of having you look at this. He really was a genius. So it's just a model that sort of says, okay, look at it this way. What you are, the coming together of these conditions. And he wants you to not, it's not good enough to say, oh, conceptually, that makes a lot of sense. We have to embody it. So that's in some sense how this practice works. There's a framework to look at. There's a conceptual understanding. And then there's practice. And then there's the embodiment. And, you know, we go through cycles of kind of getting there, and then we sort of get hooked and practice as a cycle of going deeper and deeper and more refined. And one of the interesting things about the Buddha is we talk a lot about awakening, enlightenment, but actually he talked about process. He talked about this path and that the focus is to be on the path all the time. It's not like we arrive somewhere. If you think you arrived, then you're really deluded. Then that's when a good teacher just should slam you. I haven't arrived. I will never arrive, okay? It's just constant refinement, constant exploration of all the little buttons that push us, that cause some form of dukkha, all our conditioning. And part of that's unconscious, a lot of unconscious conditioning, and it just comes up when you're sitting. And some of it is a whole view of life. So, I'd like to give a lot of examples, but actually, Larry Rosenberg, when he was in Thailand, he used to say every time he looked unhappy, Ajahn Chah would come up to him and say, "What are you attached to, Larry?" And it's a good question to ask. When you're unhappy, what is it you're holding on to? You know, are you holding on to your body, looking a certain way, feeling a certain way? Are you holding on to having a particular emotion? Views, opinions, and I could go on endlessly about this. Every one of these things is worth a talk, and I've given talks on many of these subjects. But I want to use one example that came up yesterday in the elders group. And Sam actually thought he might talk about this, but he's going through a lot of difficult stuff, so I think he's just too tired this evening. And I think he shared it with Joseph Goldstein on Sunday, so many of you have heard it. So Sam's going through, and for those who don't know, the elders group is a 65 and older group that really we're down to the old age and sickness stuff. We got down pretty well. We're just finished the death part and we'll be through it. Sam is just going through an incredible number of really difficult operations. And then every time it gets, and I mean, really life-threatening operations. And then he gets them and he's back home and it's like I'm on his helping hands list. And there's a sense of, oh, great, Sam's okay. And then a complication. And then he seems to be okay. So 3 or 4 weeks ago, I guess, something like that, I got it. Email from the Helping Hands thing, Sam had a heart attack. So the thing was that it was a mild heart attack and Sam drove himself to the hospital. And the surgeon said, "You're having a heart attack." And Sam had been taking a class from Doug Phillips on investigation. And Sam said, "Who's having a heart attack?" And he realized this body is having a heart attack. There isn't an I having this heart attack. And so what happened was that he said he wasn't detached, but there was just this calm awareness which is available to us. Just this quality of mind of stepping back and just seeing life flow So that was pretty neat. And I wish Sam were here. He offered to talk, but I think he's just going through a lot of stuff today and he's probably too tired. And then he said, and then I thought, I'm not going to get attached to this happening again. So, I mean, it was like really two really great pieces of wisdom out of that. Underlying the aggregates, the clinging to aggregates is what, and I am going to use a Pali word here, is a word tanha. Which, the reason I want to use that word is sometimes it's translated as desire. And then people are told they're not supposed to have desires. But, you know, there are desires that are skillful and there are desires that are unskillful. And we need to figure that out. Tanha is usually translated as thirst, a kind of unquenchable thirst, trying to line things up and just you just keep doing it over and over again. Sometimes, and more often it's translated as craving. Okay. And there are three forms of craving: craving for sense experiences, craving to be someone, and craving not to exist, which is kind of when you get depressed and it's overwhelming. I just don't want to be here. Okay. Which is different than seeing through all this as just a process. It's a kind of form of denial, actually. It's a conceptual way of seeing the world. So I want to talk mostly about the craving to be someone, craving for being or becoming, sometimes is the translation. I'll just say a brief thing about craving for sense experiences is that, you know, they come and go. And the Buddha actually says somewhere, running here, running there, and just chasing all over the place, trying to arrange it up so we feel good, you know. And I mean, you're just filling it up all the time. And you just see people, everybody walking along with their cell phones, you know, kind of stimulating the mind. That's a particular form of craving, right? So this craving to be is not a decision. For the most part, it's a reflex. You know, we all want to be loved, liked, be seen in a positive light, to live in a cooperative world. And yet this world of society, politics, of economics, is often not like that at all. It's a world of dissonance, of conflict. And so there's this sense of things are always going wrong. Anybody have that sense at times? Okay. And so what happens is there are these expectations about what our life is going to be. There's, I'm missing a word here. There's expectation, there's need, and there's disappointment, and there's a whole set of strategies we have developed to try and arrange the world so that will be the way we want it to be. So I got a call from someone last week who was in a relationship which had come to an end, and she said, you know, I just keep thinking if I just do everything right, it'd be okay. That's the story. That's the fabrication. That's one of the aggregates. Stories we tell. If I just do all this, everything will be okay. It's kind of like the inner critic says, if you just try harder, you'll be okay, but you can never really do that. Okay. So this craving to be someone creates the sense of someone who has a past, someone who's got a future. And if someone has a past, we can have grudges that we can hold on to, cling to. This person did this to me, and I'm really angry, and I'll never forgive them. And they hurt me, and da-da-da. I don't mean to be casual about this, because some of the stuff can be really powerful and have incredible impact on our psychological being and our body. But part of releasing that, of being free of that, is to stop the story and open up to the feelings. And so a lot of practice is learning to have enough skill to do that. And then there's, you know, there's also guilt. There's a woman in my EU group who's has been a Unitarian minister for quite some time, and she did something 4 years ago, or actually didn't do something 4 years ago that, you know, could have helped someone. I don't know the details of it. And she feels terrible about it. And the question came up, I guess, last Wednesday when I usually do that on Wednesday evenings when I'm not here. And I said, I'll save this to when I get to Right View. So this felt sense of self really wants to control things, arrange things so it'll be okay. We work really hard, we strive, so that we'll have some projected future, not a real future, but some projected future that'll be okay. We want to be seen in a positive light. And so we make effort to get approval. I mean, you know, as long as I've been practicing, I can see, like, I want to give a good talk tonight. But then I really see that. That's just a thought. It's a conditioning. And I just watch the thought come into the body, relax. Okay. Actually, I remember I used to think that no one would come up and just tell you really gave a lousy talk. But many, many years ago, I think I gave one of my best talks I ever gave, and this woman came up and said, "You didn't say anything new, and nothing was relevant to me." And I asked her, "Well, if you stay in the Q&A, you could." "No, I don't want to do that." These are kind of our teachers, right? You know, sort of see where our hooks are still. So, I mean, this desire to arrange everything the way we want can result in all kinds of striving, sometimes even addiction. And so what the Fourth Noble Truth, this Eightfold Path, is designed to help us develop mental qualities and practices that bring about cessation, bring an end to this dukkha. And this Eightfold Path has three major components to it. So there's wisdom, there's ethics, and there's the concentration factors. And at first they're conceptual, and then we need to learn to embody them. So in some sense there's this framework of what's wise, and then through practice we see that. So the first wisdom factor is wise view. And in a very deep sense, wise view means the entire Four Noble Truths. But one useful aspect, which I've given a couple talks over the last 6 months on, is viewing things in terms of cause and effect. That what we are processes. And the Sanskrit word for cause and effect is karma, so often it's interpreted as fate or something like that. But it really, and the Pali word is kama. And if you're interested, there's a really nice book called Kama, K-A-M-M-A, and the end of Kama, a PDF file by John Sachito. A really nice piece, free on the web, just Google Kama, the end of Kama. This cause and effect in the Buddhist model is that there are actions of body, speech, and mind, and there are results of that. And each time we perform an action, there's an inclination to behave that way in the future. So that if you're an angry person and you keep acting out anger, you actually create kind of a pattern or program to do that in the future. Now, one thing I think is kind of nice about looking at this model is that if you see what you are processes, and you look back and say this particular woman that I mentioned who's has a lot of guilt for her actions, my response was, well, you know, if you think about what's happening here is a long time ago, one sperm made it to an ovum. And next thing you know, there was what you call you growing in a womb and got probably pushed out rather aggressively. And then you got these two people we call parents and this whole social structure, and things happen to us. And we get all these programs or patterns that develop because we've learned to manage through that. And so for this woman, at a particular point in time, her programs were working a certain way, and she decided not to help this person. It wasn't she, there wasn't any noun there. There it is, this process is going on moment to moment, which is what the Buddha's trying to get us to see. All the stuff about aggregates, seeing the aggregates, seeing the craving. It's just all this stuff. There's nothing solid here. Concepts are solid. But reality is like changing incredibly fast. And so it's so important. That's why the Buddha, he kind of laid out this framework, but then he really tried to get you to see directly. So sometimes people actually say, practice is bare attention. That's what I heard. But we can't have bare attention. We're conditioned. So what did bare attention really mean? Now, really good people, Joseph Goldstein, who was here on Sunday, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's probably another major translator of Pali texts, says bare attention. What they mean is bare of concepts, judgments, interpretations, just to see directly, but to see directly within this framework. So it's important to know that you're not just kind of watching. You're watching within a particular thing, seeing what's dukkha, what's its cause, you know, what you're holding on to, what you're craving, and then to see it with this Eightfold Path. Right view or harmonious view, to see it in terms of your process. You are the way you are because of past conditions, and you're going to be inclined to behave in a particular way in the future because you've been behaving that way in the past. Now, the thing that's interesting is that we're intelligent processes. Or not, it's not war, but language is sort of how you can't talk about being dualistic. There are intelligent processes going on. And one of them is this ability to step back and observe like a scientist to see what's skillful and what's not skillful. What thoughts are helpful, what thoughts aren't. And the other thing is that in this process, the teaching in Buddhism is that each moment we can pause rather than acting out this inclination. And we have a little wiggle room. You know, you can't just change things drastically because you've been doing it all your life. It's like trying to start lifting weights and you start out with 400 pounds or something. It won't work. But you can probably do a pound and you can kind of develop some strength to have more and more ability to influence. And I keep using this word you, but it's just this process can do that. This intelligent process can step back and see what's going on. It's been given this framework so it can take advantage of it now. And it can look at what's skillful and what's unskillful. And the Buddha is kind of offering some teachings on this. So the second path factor is, you know, again, the translation is this word, Pali word sama is usually right, but I like Ajahn Tanissara uses the word harmonious. I like that a little bit better. Is, okay, right or harmonious intention. So he's saying these are particular patterns or programs that you ought to develop. And he's saying the patterns or programs that you should develop is to be kind, to be compassionate, renunciation, which seems like a dirty word, but actually just means to live a simple life. If you don't need so much, then you don't have to do all this stuff to get it, right? And so there's a lot of ways to cultivate these patterns. We're kind of reprogramming ourselves. And you know, it's something, don't believe the Buddha. Check it out for yourself. When you're kind to yourself, how does that feel versus when you're beating yourself up? When you open a door for someone, how does that feel when someone does it for you? I just driving over here, you know, just letting people in and out of traffic, people letting me in and out. It's the energy is good. So in some sense, there's ethics, but if you actually look underneath it, the ethics are good for us. So it's helpful to see ourselves and others this way. You know, in an example I gave, this person can kind of start letting go of guilt. If she doesn't create this identity, there's a me who did this horrible thing in the past, but sees the process, she can start letting go. And we can do the same thing with other people. I mean, that's what a lot of metta practice, loving kindness practice, is about. You know, you do it for yourself, a benefactor, someone who's easy to care for, who's helped you a lot. You do it for a friend, a little more complicated, and you do it for a neutral person, which is kind of interesting because you know, it's hard to even find a neutral person. And then you do it for an enemy. And you have to be careful about this because there's a lot of trauma or something. You know, you don't want to go there, at least until you've got some real skill to do it. But it's cultivating a skillful way of being in the world. And sometimes people are told to accept what is. But that's not what the Buddha's saying. It's like accept, allow, open to, yes. But then to see what's skillful to do. And sometimes what's skillful to do is just to be with it. Develop some skill to open to it so it can come and go. And that's part of how a lot of our underlying psychological conditioning can get released. You allow it to do what it's going to do rather than creating this other program that's been around that's fighting it all the time. So some unskillful mental states just wither away if you just watch them. That's what I was doing this evening, you know. Okay, you know, you want a good talk when people like it and all that. You just watch them, see them come and go. And sometimes you really have to do something. So the Buddha, in one discourse, I want to say one other thing before I go into this. The third factor is the concentration group, which consists of right effort, concentration, and right mindfulness. Mindfulness is a very complex thing. I'm not going to touch it. I've touched it too many times already. But one aspect of it within this three, right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness, is to recollect, to remember to keep coming back. So when you're meditating, a role of mindfulness is to say, okay, I'm with whatever you're with, being aware or being with some object, to keep coming back to it. That's the role of mindfulness. And right effort is to do things that are skillful, that create a sense of ease. So if you have a really nice breath or a nice bodily sensation, figure out how that happened. Really explore it. I mean, it's like we're just sitting here, just kind of watching the breath, you know, blah. You know, we're really kind of taking it on as like a child who's never seen a breath before. Like a child who's never seen the body before. And really exploring, oh, if I do this, this feels really good. You can get some really nice highs on this. Drug-free, and it's good for you. Um, So one thing you do when you're trying to develop concentration is, and this is true in other aspects of our practice as well, is we starve the what are called the hindrances, ill will, desire, well, craving, I'll use that word, clinging. We starve doubt, we starve anxiety, we saw anxiety, restlessness, we starve sloth and torpor. How do we starve it? We focus on something else. We see, if you're feeling anxious, then see if you can find something that's not anxious. I always joke my toes are always okay, you know, or the buttocks or something like that. Find a way, or just the rhythm of the breath. And then you focus, and then you feed the factors that make it feel good. So that means you need to see what factors make it good, and then play with it. And one of the dangers of what I'm saying tonight is that it can result in too much doing. And I think that's why a lot of teachers will say, you know, just observe, just accept. Because in this society, we want to hook it all out. We want to make it, work it, fix it. So that's a real skill. You have to figure out when you're doing too much and when you're doing the right amount. And that's something you do by trial and error. You try something, see the results. If it works, great, keep doing it. If it doesn't, you know, don't say, oh, if I just arrange everything, I'll be okay and everything will be right. And you observe that 10,000 times and it doesn't happen and you keep doing it, which is what most of us do. And it's not a criticism. It's like the whole conditioning of our lives is to believe that. So here's some suggestions the Buddha gave in terms of dealing with unskillful thoughts. Replace them with more skillful thoughts. So, you know, I remember when I was younger and had a lot more testosterone than I have at this old age, and my wife and I had a lot more passion. You know, I get really furious, and then what the mind does is it contracts. All I can see is what she did wrong. So then it's helpful to start thinking, oh, you know, actually, she's a pretty good person. You know, it's useful to, that's sort of bringing up another thought rather than kind of drowning in this stuff that's killing you. It's not doing anybody else any. You're the one that's getting the results of it. Which is why it's a good reason to start learning to forgive other people, because all that grudge and ill will towards them, you're the one that's hurting from it. And I'm not saying it's easy, but it kind of gives you a direction to go. To see that they did what they did out of causes and conditions. And it doesn't mean it's okay. But it does mean that, you know, that's how things were. And now can we see that you know, that God knows, maybe if we were in their shoes, we'd done the same thing. So then he says, focusing on the drawbacks of thoughts. So, you know, maybe you want a nice extra piece of chocolate cake, and you can start thinking about what it will feel like afterwards, and you know, all that sort of thing. Consciously ignore them. That's what I did tonight. I just, okay, well, it's coming up, and then interesting. You know, I have some conditioning is still there. Now, I don't have conditioning, there's a program there, right? Just relaxing, softening the body, softening, widening attention. And then I probably shouldn't read all this. It's hard to believe this is actually, the Buddha actually said this, but maybe he did. Forcefully suppressing them. And I'll only read a little part of it. You could probably Google it and get the whole story if you want. He says, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, constrain and crush his mind with awareness. So this is kind of like last resort. You're about to do something really wrong, and you're, I'm not going to do this type sort of thing. Okay. So kind of in summary, attention is inappropriate when it's oriented around a sense of I. Every time the word I pops up, inappropriate attention, wrong view. What do I say about some other words like should, It's appropriate when we see things in terms of actions and results. In this very moment, is this a skillful action? And skillful action is in this framework of these four noble truths. So what we want to do is learn to perceive ourselves as processes, intelligent processes. And I like to think of them as mind, body, heart. It's the way Ajahn Sucitto teaches a lot. Mind is this conceptual piece that is very useful, but also can create a lot of trouble. Heart is this felt sense. It's how we're affected by things. Someone says something to you, the conceptual piece isn't what reacts. It's this heartfelt sense that reacts. And body. In the body, if we learn to stay in the body, ground ourselves in it, it quiets the mind, it gives it ground. It's a place we can discharge emotions. And so we want to not just be aware of at some conceptual level, we want to holistic awareness of all these threat factors and how to work with them together. What leads to peace and ease and what leads to dukkha. And this is something for us to investigate directly. But all these pointers help. Because usually we run around like a head on wheels. Totally, not in touch with the heart or the body. And at some point, the heart says, this isn't working. I got to change. So the heart is actually the source of volition. It's the source of craving, this affected self. And so the way to really want to bring an end to this volition, impulsive, reactive willfulness. Ultimate freedom is stepping back from all this, seeing this as not who we are, not in a denial sort of way, but really through our own investigation, looking at things like craving and the clinging to aggregates and seeing directly, experientially, there's no solid me here, like Sam. It's not me. It's just not my body. There's no me owning the body. The body's just here. We can step back and see that. There's peace. So in some sense, what the Buddha's doing is he creates these programs, skillful programs that give us a sense of being uplifted, that, through appropriate attention of developing kindness and compassion and renunciation, and through actually the sitting process. Part of the sitting process is to create the feel-good factor and also to settle us down enough so we can actually see what I'm talking about. So when you settle down enough, then you can start seeing, this causes stress, this doesn't. And part of actually developing good concentration is seeing that. What am I doing here that I could, maybe shift a little bit to feel better? And, sometimes that's actually doing something. Sometimes that's just saying, okay, it's like this. I'm not going to fight it. That's the quality of equanimity, just like this. Okay. So basically, what we're doing is just learning to let life live itself. It's such a huge freedom. We're just vulnerable creatures. As Alan Watts once talked about in one of his books called The Wisdom of Insecurity. It's all this projection, all this desire to arrange things to be the way we are, the way we want them to be, that's the source of dukkha. So, that's great. I thought I had too much, and we're perfect timing. rare event. Okay, so Thank you. And I'll open up the questions. It doesn't have to be all related to what I talked about tonight, but since I covered all the Four Noble Truths, there's got to be something that's relevant. So I mean, I couldn't go into very much depth because this is a rather broad topic, but I think it's important to have this whole framework in mind and to figure out, you know, where do I need to, in this particular moment, what's helpful? You know, it might be a particular aspect of the path or seeing attachment or seeing craving. So anyway, the framework talk was good for me 10 years ago, so I hope it was helpful for you. Actually, more than 10 years ago, yeah.
Thanks for your talk, Ron. I kind of have two questions. You don't have to answer all of them, though. I spent some time trying to look at anxiety recently. I was trying to go somewhere and do something, and I felt that feeling, and trying to find ways to just get over it so I could try to go and do that thing. And, you know, I spent some time feeling in my body, and I sort of had some awareness of, like, I've felt this before, and, like, historically I've had lots of periods of anxiety. But I never really got anywhere with it. I didn't do the thing that I was being anxious about. It seems like anxiety is a really tough feeling to get over, because it's, your desire is to do one thing, but there are all these worries about it that you don't want to do. And it's hard to use mindfulness in that way, because when you try to use mindfulness, you don't really have that inkling of desire to do the thing after all. It's more of a feeling. I don't really know how to approach it properly in a mindful way without just jumping into the fire, which maybe is the answer, but sometimes it's hard to accept that.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of levels to work with that, and maybe it's just, we'll just talk a little bit about, maybe the first part, maybe just looking at a conceptual level, what's there, what are the conceptual fears about what will happen? And it's just a question to ask you yourself. Yeah, and then sometimes it might be helpful just to reframe it, to look at, well, okay, if that really happens, what will the result of that be? And I do think sometimes that jumping into fire is, you have to do that, you know. And then you say, oh, well, I mean, hopefully it works. And then that's kind of, lessens the anxiety about doing that same thing the next time. I don't know. I mean, is there a way you could do it in a more gradual way so it's not so...
I mean, I think finding those periods of a little anxiety but not a large amount, you know, trying to do those little anxious things and feeling that,
yeah,
and not being overwhelmed by it. Like, at that point when I was trying to feel it, I was pretty overwhelmed by it. And
yeah.
So overwhelmed that my brain just kept saying no. You don't want to do this, Ryan. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, and so underneath the thoughts, there's all this stuff going on in the body, right?
Yeah, a lot of tension, a lot of feeling inside,
yeah,
and all that.
So you might explore taking some deep breaths, and particularly on the exhalation, it's really helpful to let the exhalation be complete. So there's a lot of tension, particularly in the belly. And I would suggest even, you know, doing that in, when you're doing your formal sitting practice, because then it kind of gives you some way to do that in daily life. I remember one time that Ryan said the key to a good meditation is let your belly soften on the out-breath. And actually, I ended up doing jhanas that way, these deep states of absorption. I mean, actually, you can even do things like imagine yourself going into a deeper state of relaxation, each out-breath. even maybe using some metaphor like going down an elevator or something. So I would suggest trying to develop that skill in formal practice, because that's part of what formal practice is. It's a container that's a little more manageable from the day-to-day life. Sometimes, you know, bringing up thoughts that are, you know, because one thing that's happening is the mind contracts, right? Your mind's all focused on this, what's going to happen. Well, let me ask you, I mean, is your mind focused on what's going to happen if you do this?
Yeah.
So some of the suggestions I went through, and if you want this, I'll give it to you. I'll just throw it away. Is to try and, you know, one would be think about other things. Another is you know, I always like Joseph Goldstein's "The Sky Is Blue," because you know it's kind of like trying to widen the thought process. No matter what happens, life goes on. It isn't as important as we think it is. I remember a long time ago when portable computers were like the size of a suitcase, and I was working for this consulting firm, and I was in a hurry to catch a train because, you know, they only run every hour, and I did something, and it fell on the ground, and all the pieces went everywhere. And, you know, if I tried to pick it up and see if it worked, I was going to miss the train. It was a Friday. And I thought, you know, if it's broken, it's just going to be a story I'll tell sometime. It will pale in significance at some point in your life. Actually, it wasn't broken, but but you know, it is in some sense. It gives some perspective to it, but also I think some of this is really wired for a lot of us. You know, maybe things have happened to us. Maybe you're just born that way. I have one son who's, you know, my wife is like that. She's an anxious person. And I think one thing you can do is really to ground yourself in the body. You know, I mean, I know you're trying to do that. But maybe with the breathing process, and actually with the breathing process, Ajahn Sucitto talks a lot about rhythm. So not just watching, oh, there's an in-breath and out-breath, but just seeing how the rhythm is, and then really actually trying to really let the out-breath just be complete. And you might even try and soften the other parts of the body. And if that doesn't work, then try to do some walking meditation. Do some walking meditation in a rhythmic way. It's kind of like rocking a baby. So, what, you know, it doesn't have to be any particular pace. It's a pace that's comfortable for you. Sometimes, you know, I don't know, sometimes you have to see the part that's really anxious. Some belief system you have and bring compassion to it. I was out on a retreat to Forest Refuge, and I had this incredible realization, and all these teachers were telling me for 5 weeks, I was, wow, that's really great, encouraging me. And this teacher came in, like they changed teachers, and she basically told me I was delusional. And it was my last week, and I thought, I don't need to get into this with her. And then she put a little note on the bulletin board and said, well, if you'd like to talk about this. And so I said yes, and then I just went into this rage. You know, I'm going to straighten her out. And I told myself, well, you know, so I know all the stuff I told you plus, right? And I've done it a lot, and it wasn't working. So then I did what I told you to do next. I tried to do some walking meditation. No luck. I mean, I walked for miles, no luck. And then I saw, oh, this is your defender. It's protect. And then I just, oh, you poor thing. How hard it must be to have to do this all the time. I kind of saw the underlying force that was driving it. So I don't know. You might see if you can get some sense of what's so anxious in there. Is there some, I mean, it sounds like it's not really specific to a situation. I don't know, it's a question.
It might be. You know, there's certain things that are more anxious than others.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I just, because I don't know enough about your particular situation, but these are some things that you can explore. And, you know, if you want, I'll give you a card. You want to talk about it sometime, it's fine. Yeah. And the second question?
I don't want to monopolize, but something else I thought about with impermanence is that, especially with thoughts, there's lots of thoughts that are very sticky.
Yeah.
They just don't go away easily. So while on one hand, you know, one thought maybe, you know, take a breath, it goes away, there are some thoughts just keep going, especially with like addictions and things that, you know, you really, really like.
Yeah.
And that might be bad for you.
Yeah.
And it's like you think about that thing and then it doesn't go away. How does that relate to the idea of impermanence? Is it just that those things aren't as impermanent and they're the patterns that we're sort of dealing with?
Well, they're impermanent, but they're kind of repeating patterns, right? So they, the interesting thing about impermanence first is that, you know, it's actually all conditioned things are impermanent. It's not all things are impermanent. So these aggregates are conditioned things. There are patterns going on, and there are all these different ways that, you know, I've kind of part of what I'm going through of trying to deal with them. I think like for me, what I did tonight is I just came into the body. My concentration is good enough that after a while, you know, I'm just totally in the body and it's just peaceful. So I think one thing is to see the suffering there. Because thinking actually is tiring. It uses a lot of energy. So if you can start looking at, I have a friend who's a professor and she's really bright and does a lot of thinking, right? And so I said, well, just see if you can find it. Watch the spaces between the thoughts. So it, you know, one strategy is actually to deliberately watch thinking. I used to be very high pressure consulting work. I thought the way to do everything was just totally think about it all the time. And then I learned to just start looking at the thoughts and it like they would hide under a rock. Just bringing attention to them. Just seeing, oh. See, because what's happening when you're having the thought? You're lost in it, right? So it's okay to think. But you want to be aware that thinking's occurring. So I would say, make a decision.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.